Welcome to the Maze Marketing Podcast. This isn't another podcast about marketing tricks or hacks, but about building effective marketing systems, beating marketing overwhelm, and communicating your expertise with your hosts, Rob Drummond and Jonathan Wilson. I've been talking about page speed on and off for a few years as part of my Google Ads trainings. Google have a tool called Page Speed Insights where you can enter your website URL or the URL of a landing page, and they'll give you a score out of 100 that tells you how fast Google think it is. And depending on the host that you're using and the website that you've got and how much code you're using, they'll give you a number normally between like 10 and 40. But the question is like, well, what is the actual impact on your advertising results of those numbers? Because actually the result is very significant. So I'm going to do something a bit different. I'm going to play about a 4 minute section of recording that we recorded after the podcast call that I just thought was so profound and illustrates the impact of this really well. So let me just play this for you now and I'll come back with some comments.
Yeah.
Between 2 seconds and 3 seconds, you get the biggest increase in conversion rate. Conversion rate can go up 50% to two seconds from 3 seconds, and nobody is under 3 seconds really. And if you go between 2 seconds and 1 second, that's when the algorithms start reacting in your favor quite a long way. They want 1 second, and if you can get close to 1 second, the users don't notice whether it's 1 second or 2 seconds. It's too quick.
Yeah, for them. You said I'm taking notes as fast as I can since Rob turned the recording back off.
Thanks. Just turned the recording on. I just decided that it was easier.
So you said the biggest shift is between 2 and 3 seconds, and then another big jump between 2 and 1.
I'd say, as a rule of thumb, if you're over 4.5 seconds, that's kind of, the algorithms are a bit like, go home. You've got ad fatigue. You've got issues with deliverability. You can't reach your whole audience, that kind of thing. You'll find on Google that you're ranking low, or you're finding it hard to stay anywhere near the top three, top four, whatever it is now. But when you get to 3 seconds, that's kind of like the point in which things improve. So 3 seconds is an important landmark in the sand. The algorithms take you a bit more seriously. And we did a test where we had a page that was loading on average in 3 seconds. But some days it was loading in, say, 2.75. And other days it was loading in, say, 3.25. What was alarming is we started plotting the load time against Facebook clicks coming into the site from ad campaigns. When we had a day where the average load time was 2.75, the campaigns were delivering 4 times as many clicks as they were at 3.25 seconds. Now, the context here is that's a 500 millisecond difference between 2.75 and 3.25. And the 2.75 days, there were 16,000. And the campaign was tracked over 2 months, and it did this repeatedly. The 3.25 second days brought in 4,000 clicks. His budget was going up and down in line with that, but slightly better CPC on the faster days, but he was getting 16,000 clicks on those days. And the campaigns were left stationary. There were no changes in the campaigns. That's quite alarming. So as you travel from 3 seconds to 2 seconds, that's where you get the biggest gains of user interaction. So conversion rate and average order value tend to go up quite a lot. And when you get past the 2 second mark, when you kind of like 1.8, 1.7 seconds, you'll notice that the conversion rate stops going up and AOV stops going up because the user doesn't know the difference between what's 1.8 or 2.2 because it's still fast. But the algorithms know. The algorithms will start throwing lots of impressions at your ad campaigns if you're loading under 2 seconds. And the closer you get to 1 second, the more they do that, and they turn the dial right up, and that's where everyone should be aiming to be. And the main reason for that is that that's what they want, right?
Yeah. So
anything outside of that, if you're in that circle, you're going to get rewarded a lot, and if you're outside of that circle, it's just a gradual penalization the further away from there you get.
Yeah, Yeah, I want everybody to notice that this, what we're talking about right here, is not just a matter of a little bit better conversion rate or a little less CPA. We're also talking about the grand total traffic volume, right? Like, everybody wants to 4X and 10X their sales, right? This is
how you do it. It's literally, yeah. I spoke about my client that just launched on debut earlier on in the podcast, and we got his load times. I think he was at 2.4, and we got it down to 900 milliseconds. His weeks went from 23,000 in sales to 230,000 in sales without changing anything but the page load time in the space of 3 weeks.
Hey, it's Rob again. So I think that little introduction was so profound and hopefully has made you want to listen to this full episode. The first thing I'd like you to do, especially if you're a business owner after, you know, an overall understanding, is listen to this full episode in its entirety. The second thing I'd like you to do is to send it to your web designer or whoever manages your website, because you'll want to get some help with the technicalities. The third thing I'd like you to do, if you haven't already done so, is to subscribe to the Maze Marketing Podcast. Go to mazemarketingpodcast.com/hello. You can also help us out by leaving us a 5-star rating and review in your favorite podcast app. So the main ones being Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts. Just helps to validate this podcast as a great source of marketing insight. So having said all that, with a fairly lengthy introduction, let's go ahead and jump into the conversation. So in the SEO world, page speed has been quite a big issue for quite a long time. Most SEO experts know that, you know, since the caffeine update, like vast swathes of web pages just disappeared from Google's index overnight. I think what people are less often aware of is that page speed is really important for paid search as well. If you're sending traffic to paid, sending paid traffic to landing pages that don't load quickly, then that's both a bad user experience, but also Google will penalize you for that as well. And it's not just Google, it's all of the networks. They don't want to send traffic to pages that don't load fast, especially on mobile devices. So, you know, we've been talking a bit about this recently. Jonathan's got quite a lot of experience, but I'm really pleased today that we've got Dan Wilkinson on, who's a real expert in this. So Dan, thanks for joining us and welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Great.
Nice to see you.
Perhaps you can just start by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself and how you got into this crazy world of page load speed.
By total accident, it was not a planned maneuver to begin with at all. I started this journey in the Google Ads space and spent quite some time in there. But I was always fascinated with the data and moving deeper into analytics. So as Google Analytics started, 15 years ago, I started migrating into that quite heavily alongside of Google Ads. And then I decided that too much competition. So I went into analytics full time and was measuring all kinds of things. And when consulting with clients, we started noticing that going back about 4 years ago, that the network started really kind of penalizing ad accounts without much notice or reason. And I started spotting the patterns, the things that look like ad fatigue in Facebook or impressions dropping in Google. Were indicators more often than not of site load times going up instead of ad fatigue actually happening or fewer people searching for products. So at that point, we sat with my client who was in a bad shape because it took us a while to figure out exactly what happened one day when everything started going downwards instead of upwards. And we interviewed about 40 web developers to try and get the speed fixed. And not a single one knew how to do it. So I rolled my sleeves up and I said, I'll have a stab at this. And that first project took me about 4 months to complete. But I learned a lot in that time. The second project took about 2. The third project took about 1 month. And then from there, I migrated into page speed optimization full time.
I think there's a few interesting things in that. I think the fact that everyone has Google Analytics installed, yet the world is so scarce of real analytics experts.
Yeah.
And there's real value in knowing someone who can really pull that apart.
That's it. That's what I say a lot is the different people, when I speak to people, I mean, I've had to learn an awful lot of web development skills in order to do what we're doing. Those are learnable skills, whereas having the mindset for measuring, particularly, you know, digital media or loading patterns or even just analytics in general, without a good head for that kind of scientific measurement, it's really hard to learn as a skill. People generally are that way inclined, born somewhat with those skills, and they naturally migrate into that kind of field. Web developers, not that this is a bad thing, web developers, from my own observations, tend to become web developers because of more of a creative and artistic ideal, where they want to create something, build something. And I'm not developing websites. I'm optimizing them. I'm taking things out. I'm not putting things in. That's generally, you know, that's what we do with Google Ads as well. That's what we do with analytics, is you get a better read of analytics when you stop tracking the things you don't need to track, rather than finding more things to track. You want to track what's important.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you apply 80-20 much?
Yeah. Yeah. 80-20, I always like, what's the top five say?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really interesting that you're saying about the sort of drop off, like this kind of insidious drop off in performance that probably just gets attributed to something else altogether. And it could just be the page speed that's rating to those.
That example in particular was this. Everybody does this with a Shopify site. I have no idea why anyone thinks it's a good idea, knowing what I know now. I remember this very clearly. It was July the 9th, and the client had 6 months of growth, and they were going into the busiest period of the year because what they sell is very summertime. And July the 9th, the Facebook ads started tanking, and we did not know why. And what he did on that day, he didn't tell anybody, is he installed an app. I think it was Bold Upsell. Didn't like it, and he uninstalled it again. But what we didn't know at the time was how littered with code that was. And it made the site load time before then was about 4.5 seconds. And after he did that, it was 5.5 seconds. And that was enough to tip it over the edge. The average Shopify site is 5.5 seconds.
I want everybody listening to hear that again. The only change was from 4.5 to 5.5 seconds. Most people would say, no big deal, right?
Correct. Yeah, correct.
It's a big deal.
It's more so that was then. Now it's more like 3.5 to 4 seconds is the tipping point. A big tipping point. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I knew, just to not to interrupt your flow, but just briefly, I have a colleague who runs Facebook ads only. He runs a Facebook ads agency, and he was doing some testing, I think it was last year, and he was doubling the conversion rates of his campaigns, which usually automatically halves the CPA as well, right? And all he was doing was shaving like half a second. He was going down from like around 4.5 to 3.5 or something like that. Yeah, and no changes to the ad account at all, and like doubling his performance just by shaving a half a second off the load speed time.
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing to see. I see that all the time, and I'm always a very keen. It's a good job I have the ads background, because I'm able to read all that data correctly. We ran a test just recently with a client. The client's about the 30, 40 million mark a year kind of size. So we've got lots of people visiting the site, so we can conclude tests really quickly. And we're updating the landing pages with a new back-end code system to improve the page view scores after the recent change. And I said, let's run the identical landing page side by side, and one with the old code in it and one with the new code in it, and split test it from Facebook. That's a good idea. I wonder what that'll do. And the newer page, which was loading in, they were both loading in the same time, second for second. The page load times were the same. And but the perceived the user experience of watching it load was better on the newer page, and less janky, and it was a smoother flow. And that page converted about 25% better, but
wow.
Facebook was charging about 25% more for those clicks going to that page. So what Facebook, because they've got history with the original URL, so I just switched the URLs over so that the newer page became the older page and vice versa. And then all of a sudden we watched Facebook just suddenly out of nowhere produce 40, 50% more impressions to those.
Wow. Let me make sure I understood that right. So they picked up that the new page on a new URL was behaving different and they charged more for it. What was it that, or was it the other way around? The other
The test was new page versus old page.
Yeah.
And we were expecting it to give us cheaper clicks, but it didn't. Yeah. And I think that's an age of the ad. So with a newer URL, they were charging more without having the history of it.
That makes sense.
That's my take. You know, mm-hmm. plenty of people can disagree, and I'm fine with that. You know, we have lots of theories, but when we switched the URLs over so that the faster page was on the URL that they're used to, that's when the impressions flooded in.
Yeah,
we had cheaper CPCs, more impressions, higher click-through rate, and higher conversion rate. And that's attacking e-com growth from all three sides.
And you mentioned a few minutes ago about the recent change. Could you elaborate?
The Google, I took no notice originally. Google's always making changes, and I thought this was another one of their, hey, come and have a look at this new crazy feature in our PageSpeed tool. For the longest time, I've been ignoring PageSpeed Insights, right? Yeah. I've been thinking it's a rubbish report. Different every time you make a test. Yeah. And then they bring out this new thing called Core Web Vitals. And I was thinking, Core Web Vitals, what kind of name is that, really? And I took no notice of it. But within a week, I got contacted by about 15 different people, all very concerned about it. So I thought I'd go digging into it. And when I did that, I started picking up on Google's keywords. Jonathan, remember the posts I was putting in Facebook?
Yeah.
Yes. This is all about Google's language. Nothing to see here. Nothing to worry about.
Yeah.
Till towards 2021. I'm thinking that sounds like just before Black Friday.
Oh, yeah.
Don't worry about your impressions. Don't worry about your search rankings. Not happening yet. We'll sting you right before holiday season.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure that Google is the best in the world at playing dumb while knowing way too much.
So the Core Web Vitals, when I went reading online, it was a very simple, a slightly different way of producing the data. Google's own wording is this is to bring the data more in line with what entrepreneurs might want to see because it's more focused on user experience. The reality is that the way that they were measuring speed before they introduced the new initiative was sideways from the way they're measuring it now. So all of our optimizations and most people's optimizations were about getting the document into the browser really quickly and getting something on the screen really quickly. That's no longer the case. That's not what they're measuring anymore. They're measuring how long does it take you to load the largest contentful part of the above the fold. Most websites, particularly e-com, it's a huge image, right?
A big banner.
Images can take a while to download, and the difference between 2 seconds and 3 seconds is 10 points on page speed. If you go to 4 seconds, it's 25 points deducted.
It's kind of interesting to me that change that you just pointed at. So it's actually pretty well in keeping with the way Google has always viewed usability and user experiment, right? Like we always say that at the end of the day, what Google cares about the most is literally keeping users on Google. So if people go to Google and they do a search and they get what they want faster and better than anywhere else in the world, they're going to stay with Google. And they know that. This is the reason. This is why Google can give preference to users over advertisers, right? And the trend that you're pointing at there is really consistent with that, because what they're saying is, okay, we don't just want a technical good experience. We want real people who are really trying to use that page to actually have a good thing happen when they get to the page.
Yeah.
Well, Google's always been about speed. That was the original reason that Google was better than AltaVista and Lycos and all of these other things.
It was Remember in the very early days, they used to actually say right below the search results, like how fast it took them to run the query?
Do they not still do that?
Well, no, good question. Maybe they do. I hadn't noticed it in a long time. Like
2 million results in how important whatever of a second.
Yeah, that's been there forever. Yeah, if they've taken it down, I haven't noticed them take it down, but it's been a while since.
There. Yeah, no, it's still there.
Still into it. Well, yeah, and Google were saying not so long ago that with regards to page speed optimization, you really want to get some content that the user can start using. And it's a form of illusion. So what the search engine was doing, I imagine they have changed the way that this is happening now to fall in line and practice what they're preaching. But what the search engine is that thin white bar at the top of the screen with the Google logo in. And then below that, it's a large white box with listings, right? So they'd load that small thin header lightning fast, and then they would load the search results. And what that was doing was allowing the algorithms another, I don't know, 50 milliseconds to load the content, which made all the difference to them when they're doing however many billion searches a day. It was making a big difference to keeping their edge over, particularly early on, over their competition, which they're now very separated from.
So you're not just trying to load the entire page really quickly. It's the part that people see initially that they need to see something quickly. And then if there's bigger things further down the page, it's maybe not the end of the world.
Correct, and that's still the case, but their shift in the way that they're measuring is specifically, instead of getting something on the page, you have to get what they're going to see on the page as quickly as possible. And there's three measurements that they really care about. The two of these measurements make up half of the page speed score, and that's just on the two measurements alone. So you can fix these two things, and if they're really bad, then you can fix these two things and you've added 50 page speed points onto your page speed score out of 100. So the first one is the largest contentful paint, LCP, and that is getting the main visual attraction above the fold loaded as quickly as possible. So if you have lazy loading on that image and you have to wait for the scripts to kick in to then enable it on the screen, then download the image and then put it there, it's too late. That's not gonna please them. No. So
can you just define what lazy loading is?
Yeah, where you you write the image tag without the source URL in there, and instead you put data source and you run a script to convert the data source into a source at the right time. Usually as the image is about to pop onto the page. And it can do that very, very quickly, but every millisecond counts these days.
Like the original, kind of in layman's terms, the original idea behind lazy load is that a lot of the page code can load and then those big heavy elements can kind of get back around to it to finishing up later.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, as needed, like having big images at the bottom of the page and the user doesn't even scroll down. They use the menu instead. And they go to another page. They never needed to load those images below the fold. So that's the premise behind it. It's still a very valuable thing to do.
Yeah. Is there a happy medium? So you just said it's still valuable, but there must be a happy medium. Then on that, some things need to not lazy load and other things should.
Yeah, lazy load anything off the screen and prioritize everything on the screen. So... it's things like logos and icons and little things that generally speaking people are using images for, or small SVG files, is convert them into SVGs and add them just directly to the code so that they're already there. They don't need downloading when the document moves. And if you're using gzip compression, anyone with a Shopify site is. And there's a lot of plugins for things like that for WordPress. If you have a 10 kilobyte image or an SVG block of code and you put that into the document, the transfer size of that's less than 2 kilobytes because the compression just gets compressed. So that's fine. I'm always happy with the SVG less than 10 kilobytes.
Yeah.
So that really helps because you're speeding up the process because that code's already there, and then it only needs to get the image that you want to load. So you can preload those using preload links at the top of the head for those. What gets complicated is when you want to get the right sized image for a mobile versus the right sized image for the desktop, because the server that's delivering the code doesn't know what size the screen is.
Yeah.
Only the browser knows that.
is that a reason for having like mobile specific landing pages?
That's a good way around it, yeah. And if you use a service like Cloudflare or something, you can that can redirect it to a mobile page really fast. You might only be losing 20 or 30 milliseconds. And they've got that feature built in. If you have
is that based on device detection? So if you go on a phone, it recognizes that you want to phone.
Yeah, because they are Cloudflare is a DNS bridge, so they sit directly in between the site and the device. They're not like off in a silo off to the side of the queue being called for. They do all the DNS resolving, so they know exactly what the device is before they've even called the files from the server, so they can redirect on the way to the server. Then there's if you allow people with mobile phones to get to the page and it goes, oh, this is a mobile phone, and then you have a redirect built into the page, that's going to cost nearly half a second. That would be too long. You'd be better off having a big image.
Yeah. This is quite the science project. You're trying to weigh all these different pathways to the fastest lifetime against each other.
Yeah. it's a balancing game. You've got to find the right it's usually a case of the lesser of the two evils. It's hard to get a perfect scenario. Do you really have to have a magic zooming image right above the fold? Because you know that's just like 8 JavaScript plugins, 3 images in that one space, and or whatever, and the carousel, and the whatever else, the images for the selections and whatever. That's a terrible loading product page.
So there's probably a correlation there between like graphical elements that you don't really need, and that's probably an easy win, I think, isn't it?
Yeah. We kind of address. We always get asked the same questions with every prospect that we chat to, and the questions are: what will my page score be? Page speed insight score be? How fast will the site be? You're not going to ask me to change anything, are you? And you're not going to ask me to uninstall any apps, are you? So we've worked really hard at trying to maintain those 4 things. And as long as we can maintain those 4 things, we have an easy sale. So, but that can be a real challenge to we might struggle sometimes with some of the apps that are out there to meet all 4.
is apps like the main issue? I mean, are there issues kind of baked into a lot of the themes that people are using as well?
Yeah, it's I think when you're taking platforms that are on old code bases, Shopify is a really good example. You only have to go back a couple of years and they didn't have the section. It was all templates and snippets. So you come across some themes today that have no sections in there. That information, you don't really need to know too much about that, but it's a key part of the templating language in the Liquid. So when you don't see the sections, then the server's got a lot of rummaging through snippets to get the page built quickly to deliver it to the browser. So that could have an onward effect. So if you're on a very new theme in Shopify, you'll find that the delivery to the browser will be really fast because Shopify's got a lot of new features. Discontinued a lot of their original Liquid tags. Now they're starting to mount up. Nobody knows that the include tag has now been depreciated. And you see it's the most common tag in all liquid files.
But what is the include tag? Sorry, I'm going to ask a lot of, like, I'm a copywriter here, yeah. So I'm going to ask
a lot of questions. It's so that you can include a snippet from somewhere else. So if you have a piece of code that gets reused, you can just have an include tag.
Oh, I see.
Call that in, but they've changed that now. So they're, you've got to keep on top of these changes and keep modern. I think WordPress does a really good job of going, whoa, you're out of date. Update now. that's a really good thing in the app developers. But from a page speed optimization point of view, that's also makes it really difficult because you can't make lots of code changes to WordPress because it gets overwritten. So that makes WordPress difficult to optimize in some respects.
It does using a custom theme as well.
Yeah.
I guess if you're just using, like, I'd pretty much stick to just using commercial themes that I could update without breaking the whole thing.
But it's all the scripting that's behind it. You can't avoid downloading jQuery usually with WordPress, whether you need it or not. Often you have limited control over the images, whether you need them or not. Whether you want to lazy load them, there are some really good plugins out there to help. But then I've found that with using plugins alone to keep the theme safe, and when you try and optimize too hard, you start getting into stability issues.
Yeah.
But you've got like caches and concatenations and CDNs. Somewhere you start seeing style breaks and HTML breaks and things looking weird.
What's a CDN, sorry?
Say again, sorry?
What's a CDN?
CDN, Content Display Network? No, that's the delivery. Google thing, isn't it? Content Delivery Network. Yeah. Wow, where did that come from? We haven't had the CDN for years. Yeah. The second big thing for page speed scores is called the first input delay, or the FID, F-I-D. And if that's over a couple of hundred milliseconds, you get a really bad page speed score. And what that is as the document gets delivered to the browser starts going haywire through the document, reading it and downloading every resource it's in there, telling it to download. And there's a couple of rules. So if something's marked as async, it'll carry on reading the document whilst that's downloading in the background, and then the browser will try and use it immediately after it's downloaded. Then you have the defer thing, which it will throw it out, let it download, and then use that at the end. So that's another one. But they can't really do that with images. You can't really do that with a lot of resources. Iframes, if you put an iframe in, it immediately starts loading another page before it'll continue with the page. So all these things take a bit of a toll. The CPU level on the browser whilst it's doing all of that, if you've got a decent connection speed, will be close to 100% as it's doing it as fast as it possibly can. If the CPU is high and it's trying to load the content and you get the pixels on the page, because you've got a good LCP, but the background running lots of tracking scripts, so you've got 14,000 events to track with analytics and Facebook, because you need all this data for remarketing lists, and days are numbered with that, I think, with the CCPA and GDPR. Then the page is janky, and that ruins user experience, because the CPU is busy trying to get all this information out of the user and the page. So the first input delay is how long does it take for the CPU of the browser to stop just for a second? And it's 1 second.
Oh, wow.
So you can stop everything for 1 second as soon as all the pixels are on the page, and then that's where Google stopped tracking the page load. It doesn't matter when the page actually loaded, that's when they stopped tracking it. The event that happens immediately after that is the time to interactive. So if you ever wonder why you see a report that says my pages are loading in 1 second, but the time to interactive is 20 seconds, well, The page carried on loading for 20 seconds after that. That's what it's saying. So that they're really keen on that. Those two things alone are 50% of the page speed score.
Wow.
And
so if I load a page, so and you see like the circle going around in the top bar, is that the time to be interactive? Because I can see the page, it's still going round, I guess. That makes sense.
Yeah, it will be. Yeah, because that will stop when it's got nothing else. I mean, you're familiar with like, you know, you're on a page and it's stopped, and you're familiar with knowing that further things are downloading into the page afterwards. But the loading circle doesn't come back once it's stopped, usually. Unless there's a problem,
it's trying to get
a resource from somewhere else with a, you know, with a call or something.
Go on, Jonathan, you're the question master. I know you've got.
Yeah, I'm actually just kind of sitting here thinking, I wonder what this sounds like to the average Perry Marshall type internet marketer. I mean, maybe we should take a step back and just help people understand that at the end of the day, right, like pages are data passing from the server, right, that thing in the cloud that you never see, to your device, right, your browser on your computer, your mobile phone. And basically what we're talking about the fine technical under the hood stuff. But at the end of the day, the point is that Google wants people to hit websites and be on websites that are a quick, fun, and engaging to use, right? And they know that people, if they try to go to a page and like it's just not happening, it's slow to load, hard to use, slow to navigate, it's just going to right, it's gonna have a less enjoyable experience. And so in order to make Google happy, you have to basically re-engineer the way your page is actually built and being conveyed from the server into your browser, right? And so the net experience is that in the end, your page not just loads faster, but everything is actually easier to use.
Correct.
Yeah.
I feel like it's an aspect of usability about this as well, isn't it? Because it's obviously usability to the end user, but it's also usability to Google as well.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's been in the SEO world, it's been the case for years that it's obvious that Google, because in order to do an index of a site, they have to crawl your whole website, right? And it's been fairly obvious that sites that they can crawl quickly get a higher ranking than sites that literally become like a honeypot trapping the crawler into spending a year on the site, right? I believe that they don't say this, but I believe, so I have experience with data center management, and I think that Google at the end of the day is actually concerned, as funny as it sounds, I think they're concerned with computing power and energy resources at their data centers. I mean, just try to imagine the amount of horsepower, so to speak, that it takes to continuously scan the entire internet, right? And so if they can save 1%, they're probably like, that's probably an entire coal mine per year that they're not having to burn through.
Yeah. I mean, what is the Google Cloud? You know, is that like a third of total cloud out there?
Or
you know, you got the Google Cloud, and you got the Amazon Cloud, and then you've got lots of small ones, I think.
Yeah.
And any modern hosting plan is usually cloud based now in an ever growing server space that's constantly upgraded. So how many of those are in Google Cloud? Because I know Shopify is in Google Cloud. I know Cloudflare is in Google Cloud. And you can tell when Google Cloud has a problem, it's the sites you can't access are all on that same platform. And so when everyone's got a slow site and it's just interacting with the server way too much, it could be bringing down other systems. It could be providing instability there as well.
Yeah, literally. I'm curious. So I know you've worked a lot with Shopify. Have you also tried this on like whatever BigCommerce, Volusion, Magento?
Not Magento. I really don't like the look of the file system, so I've avoided it.
Yeah. At the end of the day, do you find that it's all the same, or are some of them intrinsically more difficult to optimize?
So it's all the same. It doesn't matter whether you're what page you're on. Everyone's loading jQuery. Everybody's loading jQuery UI. Everybody's loading images. Everyone's loading YouTube iframes and Wistia iframes and everything that comes in between. So the server to browser doesn't care about the operating system or the platform that it's coming from. Having said that, the more restrictions there are in the platform, the easier it is to do lots of them, about lots of different ones. That's probably why I like Shopify so much, because they're growing. They're getting a lot more people coming on and getting a Shopify store going. I think they've tripled their, I think they've doubled this year, haven't they? I think they've doubled in the last 6 months, which is just astonishing, because they quadrupled last year. And Big Commerce is a much smaller company, but their platform is a lot more grown up.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah,
a lot more developer free creativity and freedom. Whereas Shopify has its restrictions, because you're in there, you still have the seven folders, and in the seven folders you have the files that you have to have, and you can add more and things like that. And that's how your theme's built. With Big Commerce, you can have a very expansive file system. The same with WordPress as well. You can have a very expansive file system.
Yeah, yeah.
Why am I struggling to think of any more platforms? I think isn't that just it?
Yeah, that's funny. There's a lot of little ones, but I think those really are those and WooCommerce, which obviously is part of WordPress, and definitely 80/20. That's most of the platforms right there. Yeah. Everything else I can think of, I mean, like, I'm pretty sure Intuit, which is QuickBooks, I think they have a platform with a cart and such, but I don't think there's any hope of that, right? All in the hood. Yeah. When you work with a client and you find that the theme, the whole thing is just designed wrong, do you often start by replacing the theme entirely, like, you know, just scrap this and let's start over from scratch, or not too often, you just work with what they've already got?
Sometimes I suggest it's a good idea to rebuild the theme from scratch. Mm-hmm. And often that's easier to do that. And because I was working on a site last week and I did not do this. We didn't build this site. It would have been easier to have done that if we'd recognized how hard it would be from the beginning.
Yeah.
The site was about 7 years old and it had all kinds of code. What was worse is the owners didn't know what they were using and what they weren't using. Yeah. Are you using Buddha Mega Menu? No idea. They had all this code for different menus, which all the menus were the same. There were different platforms all installed. Buddha Menu, Bacon Menu, which is now Meteor Menu. They even had all the tags for Sweet Tooth. And I was thinking, what is Sweet Tooth? And that later changed their name to Smile.
I've never heard of either one.
That was quite a long time ago. Yeah, it was about 4 or 5 years ago. They changed to Smile. Everyone's heard of Smile now. I think there's the rewards program that you see everywhere.
Oh, okay.
Yep. But that they used to be called Sweet Tooth. I'd never heard of Sweet Tooth before. When I Googled it, I was just like, oh, it's Smile. That's obviously dead code. But yeah, sometimes we offer to upgrade the theme. If we think they're going to say no, would you like the theme upgrade? The answer is always yes to that. So we might then rebuild it anyway. Sure. But most of the time we're able to work with what we've got. Probably 80-90% of the time we're not looking to replace the theme. We might replace every last line of code in there in the end sometimes, but it's still the same theme, right? Doesn't matter how many times you change the handle or the head on a brush, it's still the same brush.
Yeah. You should produce your own theme set, like Dan's super optimized baseline.
Super quick.
It's kind of developing that way because sometimes we get requesting people ask for features and something like like sections that are parts of a website. I started thinking about what if we had like a multifaceted section that can just do everything. So you just need to load a new section, tick a few boxes, and then it could server-side script in a code that creates it or something. So that's my next thought, which is on the shelf until I get around to it, which may never happen. But I think it's a good idea.
Until then, is there any particular themes, like by name or by company? For example, when I don't deal with building sites much anymore at all, but when I do still, I recommend that people start with something like Genesis or some core and stable WordPress theme, right? Rather than going to, because what people tend to do is they go to a place like ThemeForest, right? And they buy the prettiest one or the one with all the options, which is automatically the one that's the most bloated, right? And so I try to steer people in the other direction to start with something really minimal, the studio press.
Get something really minimal, like 2017.
That's what it was, right? Installed with the website.
Yeah, exactly. The fastest WordPress theme, I think, is 2017 or 2018. Probably 2018 is the fastest one. The fastest Shopify theme is Debut. That's the Shopify's free one. Why? There's nothing in there. And Shopify is a cloud platform. They really do try and get their sites loading as fast as possible. The fastest Boost Commerce theme, I'm not sure which one that is. Boost Commerce is a bit different because you really have to develop those quite extensively. But the fastest non-WordPress theme page builder, I think, is Oxygen. I really like working with Oxygen. Okay. The trade-off with Oxygen and not knowing how to code is that you'll have a very, very steep learning curve. So now OptimizePress, Thrive Themes, both of those still require some knowledge. You get Elementor is a lot more user-friendly. It's not too bad. But then you have like built for your themes. Like, I can't think of any names now. I stopped using them so long ago. Right. But something like Salient. Do everyone remember Salient? The big parallax theme. Yeah. Everybody used that in 2016. And it's still popular today, but that's a theme, a classic theme that takes a long time to load, looks very good once it's loaded, video backgrounds and all kinds of stuff. But even just with an image background, it's still loading all the video plugins because it has to. It's giving you these options. It doesn't know how to rewrite its own code, so it loads all these things in. Oxygen Builder is a really good theme. The only thing is using it in the back end is quite cumbersome. It can be a little bit buggy sometimes as well.
There's Divi too. Tons of people were into Divi a couple of years ago.
That's still going strong. I think it's the power struggle, I think, now is Oxygen, Elementor, and Divi. Mm-hmm. From what I can see, but I might be only seeing things with closed groups and blinked eyes. Yeah. I haven't been looking at the whole industry. But also, there was a period where it was just all about optimized press and Thrive Themes, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yep. Thrive Themes was notably quick when they started, but they've been adding more and more and more features, and their themes are getting very, I don't want to use the word bloated, it's not necessarily true, but their CSS is quite heavy. Everything's based on the ID of the element you're adding. So they're adding, so you can't, they have a lot of CSS, a lot less HTML, but a lot more CSS. Mm. CSS can be using just the IDs. The browser's quite like that because it just goes, oh, you belong to this block, you belong to that block. But if you're putting a box shadow on every other block, and you're putting text shadow all over the text everywhere, it's loading all of that code to tell it to do that for each one, whereas you're probably using the same the same text shadow, right, or the same box shadow, and that could only need to be introduced once. All elements use this shadow, or all elements with a class shadow in it can use this shadow, and that'd be that'd make it a lot easier for the browser.
Do you find, and I get that real well, are OptimizePress and Thrive Themes, like, are they, nonetheless, are they at the head of the pack, or are they somewhere way back in the middle?
I think they're way back in the middle now. They were once, they were really good landing page builders to begin with, and then they are edging into being theme builders, but they didn't get the, I don't feel that they got the breakaway they came in on one thing, which is, you know, build a landing page inside of your WordPress site. Not really a theme or whatever, but you've got like Oxygen, Divi. I mean, Divi, well, it's the company that did Divi. They had like, you could subscribe and they've got like, you know, all the themes you could pick from. So I think a lot of web designers were using that as a portfolio to show people.
Yeah, yeah.
I've forgotten the name of the company now, but is it Colorful Themes or something like that? I don't know.
Yeah,
but then they produced Divi, which was like I think it was the first theme that I heard of where this theme is so moldable that there is just the theme that it's a builder. It's not a theme that you customize. This is, you make the theme out of this thing.
Yeah.
I think they stayed quite strong. And out of that, you had then have the several others. It's taken Thrive a very long time to get a theme builder together. They've only really just released one.
Yeah, it's brand new, isn't it?
Hmm.
Cool, cool. Talk about Tag Manager for a minute. So you've already mentioned.
Oh, you know I love Tag Manager, Jonathan.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we've already talked about, you mentioned earlier that a big source of slowness often is all those tracking codes loading, right?
And yet, oh, yeah.
As marketers, Rob and I are mostly, our audience is people running paid traffic, right? Specifically. So the one thing we all, as paid ads marketers, won't be doing is removing, right, our conversion tracking tags. It's going to be there. So what's your best hope for salvaging that information?
I want to dispel a myth, actually. The general myth out there is that, this is because every set of instructions tells you to do this. You have to put the snippet in the head, right, of the page. Put it somewhere near the opening head tag. The reason why every network wants you to do that is because they get their script fired and they can monitor the page before anyone abandons. You have to bear in mind that most pages online are slow. They're really slow. If you have analytics, Facebook, Pinterest, Quora, YouTube, additional YouTube trackers, and then you've got, did I say analytics already? You've got AdWords and then whatever else you want to put on there.
LinkedIn, then Facebook.
There's a lot of them, right? Yeah. You then want to put Outbrain and Taboola on there as well. You've got essentially what is the same script being executed many times over. Mm-hmm. I was having a chat with the owner of Gorgeous, the chat widget, last year at the BGS event in Reno, and he said, "Yeah, but our snippet's only 122 characters. So how can that slow it down?" And I said, "I optimized the site yesterday with your widget on it. I quite like it, by the way. It was really easy to optimize." He asked me what I meant, and I said, "That snippet that you think is responsible for loading your chat is a link." It just looks like a script because it's an asynchronous link. That's what we call it. And it's not like, you know, link source equals. It's got a little bit more construction to it. But that's what the analytics script is, where it says isogram. That's what your gtag script is. That's what the tag manager script is. The first thing they do, they run asynchronously. The first file they downloads asynchronously. And then each of them, like, they kind of bloom out like a firework or a big flower, kind of like. Then they open up all the HTTP requests that they want, firing out pixels to track the page. Mm-hmm. And you can get a bit heavy with Tag Manager in particular. You can start tracking all kinds of things really easily. I want to know what the page load time is. I want to know how far they're scrolling. I want to get an event every percent down the page that they travel. I want to know if they click the YouTube. So meanwhile, the user's on the page and all the page is just doing is going ping, 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 firing off all these one pixel images off to the ad networks and running scripts that all have callbacks. And so, the tracking scripts can be a total headache for a loading page whilst it's still loading. And you get pages, tracking can slow down by 10-15 seconds if they've just all been blindly pasted into their head. Tag Manager helps you resolve that. I keep seeing Tag Manager with Google Analytics in it, and then an AdWords G tag next to it, and then the Facebook tracking code next to it. You think, why don't they why don't you just put all of the trackers inside of Tag Manager, and don't stop there. Put your chat widget in there as well. Don't bother your website with Klaviyo. Put Klaviyo in Tag Manager. Really easy. Just put the snippet in there instead. And I take in the direction of running a data layer push in the store that just has every variable in the data layer push that the tracking scripts need. So that might be average. That might be the order value. It might be the order number. It might be the product ID. Just on the relevant pages, just have a data layer push that calls the information from the server just one time. And then you can have that as a variable inside of Tag Manager. And then you can get Tag Manager just to do all the heavy lifting of all the tracking. And we run all kinds of things from Tag Manager very successfully and seamlessly. One thing I enjoy doing when I get a page load time below 2 seconds, you'd never consider this a 7 second page load time, is to write Google Tag Manager, rewrite their tracking snippet, wrap it in event listeners so that it only executes after the page is loaded. So if you've got a page load time that is less than 2 seconds, the average human interaction to do anything is 3 seconds. I mean, it takes about 3 seconds to receive a message, process it, and then go to respond to it. By the time that you see something you don't like and you click the X button, that takes about 3 seconds. So if you've got a page that loads in 2 seconds, you can afford not to run any of the tracking scripts at all, and then wait 1 second and then run them all.
Nice. That's really
and then,
nice.
Then you got a 98, 99, 100 page speed score. Because that's exactly what Google wants you to do.
I don't know what the right terminology is, with like a human biological, physiological thing. And the good news is that's not going to get any faster anytime soon.
But what's interesting is anyone that's a marketer that relies on their tracking is like, no, I'm not running a whole page load without running any tracking. What happens if, and then what follows are what happens if. I generally answer those questions with exactly the same answer. And that is, if you load your page in 2 seconds or even 3 seconds, and then you wait 1 second and then you load all your tracking scripts, then your tracking scripts will have loaded it within 5 seconds, right? But if you go the opposite way and the tracking script's executing at the same time as the render process, which is very heavy on the CPU, you might be delaying the page load by 5 seconds.
Yeah, literally.
You might have a 7, 8, 9. So the tracking still loads at the same time. In many cases it does. Yeah, you prioritize your tracking by doing that in Tag Manager quite easily. I set all the trackers to window loaded as well.
Yeah.
I wanted to dispel a myth. How does analytics know how long the page load time took if you load analytics after the page is finished loading?
I was literally about to ask that. Okay, go ahead.
In my mind, it works by magic.
It would be a huge drain of Google's resources to be actively measuring how long a page takes to load every time it does. But instead, the browser has a start request stored in the JavaScript window. I think it's window.performanceTiming.timing.startRequest or something along those lines. If you start typing that line in, it'll start auto-completing for you, and you very quickly find the Unix time for the click that happened to start the load from starting. When the load finishes, there is an end of load request that marks the page load event. So all analytics does, doesn't do anything. It waits for it to finish loading. It goes, oh, look, we've just had the load event. I'm going to go and ask it how long it took. So it gets the start time and the end time and deducts one from the other, which leaves you with a millisecond load time. And it just records that as an event.
So in other words, Google isn't actually measuring that. It's just asking the browser what happened.
Yeah, Chrome measures it using the computer's CPU, not Google's CPU.
That's
Safari measures it. Firefox measures it. Yeah, analytics reads what it was. Facebook yeah. reads what it was. And so
what else does that apply to? How about things like, I'm just trying to think in what a marketer would want as the page is loading. So what about like scroll depth or video watch time? Is it the same thing? It's just reading events out of the browser, or does it actually measure something in that case?
Yeah, so video, particularly videos above the header, are a huge problem now. If you want a high page speed score and you don't want Google to penalize your ad accounts, if you have an above the fold header or a GIF, I have a client that's mad on GIFs. I have to keep saying, don't talk to me about GIFs, just do a short video. And if you have a video, the video takes time to load, and you have to think about it I have a great metaphor for this, is that if you walk into your living space and you want to look at a picture, you might have this flat thing with a picture on it and you go and stick it by the wall, right? If you want to, I'm not sure, Rob, if you know what we're talking about. Video is like this electronic format, or whether you remember the cassette tape videos or...
Oh, yeah.
But imagine trying to put one of those on. You need to plug your TV in. You need to get your video player or DVD player or even just Netflix. There's a lot more involved in getting moving things going, and the iframes are just like that. The first thing that happens with all of the major video networks like YouTube, Wistia, or Vimeo is they have to download the player. They download the player, then they download things like the thumbnails that go in there. They start, and they do it in that order because the video file itself takes longer to load, and they need to get something into that block. So you get the play icon, and then you get an image that kind of sticks, which is usually the frame that you can select inside of the network as the still front image. So they're downloading an image, and then they start downloading the MP4. The good thing about MP4 files is they can be buffered, right? They only need to get the first couple of seconds before they can start playing it, but it still takes a few hundred milliseconds to do that. And that slows your, this is the difference between life and death, isn't it? When you want to please Google with that 25% of the page speed score for ad benefit, with the largest contentful paint, if your largest contentful paint is the video player, then that's not good. when it's talking about paint, it's not saying it's okay, that's a video player. It's talking about pixels on the screen. It doesn't matter what it is. It's just pixels on the screen. They're thinking about that very two-dimensionally.
Just thinking about like stuff like Wistia, is it faster to just have like the image and you click on the image and it kind of pops up the video separately, because then it's not loading the player in the first instance?
Yeah, I mean, if you want it to autoplay on load, that's getting more and more problematic. But yeah, of course, yeah, I definitely think it is. You can have an image that has been designed with the right colors to keep the size down and the right format. It's using WebP when you're using Chrome. I don't know if you know that WebP doesn't work on Safari, and Safari's like taking nearly 65% of the search market now with the iPhone. And lots of people blindly use the Safari on their Macs, but I don't think it applies to Windows quite the same, does it? The WebPs don't load on Safari. I've had so many people just put WebPs in their website using Chrome because it's the best tool to design with, and then they didn't realize that their images weren't showing on an iPhone or on a Safari browser. So you have to be really careful with different formats and stuff. I've forgotten the question now, Rob.
I was talking about, so instead of having the player load when the page loads, you just have an image and you click the image and it kind of pops up the player.
Yeah, you can. In like a box, like a modal, quite easily. Yeah, we've done that an awful lot where you click on the video and then the modal literally loads the video once you've clicked on it, and even have an image that looks like the video player. Then you click on it, it just replaces the frame with the iframe. Just an on click, follow this small script kind of request. And anybody wanting to know about like how to write a script to do that, just Google on click load iframe, and you'll get the W3 schools thing. It'll give you code written example for you to go and play with. great thing about JavaScript is it's 20 years old and there's a lot of resource out there.
That is good, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And we've worked with a few sites that have like a video background, and you can't change from the video background until you've tested something that converts better, right? Even if it's slightly slower. But yeah, my trick is with a video player is to have the video player inside of a div frame. So you load the video player into another HTML window, and then set a background image that's lightweight on that thing. So the background image fills that space and creates the paint to please Google. And then
you just worry about the video as you need it.
Yeah, they don't like solid rectangles very much, because they tend to choose, if you have a massive black rectangle and you have a little picture, I've seen time and time again that the report tends to choose the picture, even though it's much smaller, as the larger contentful paint. So you want to have some content in there. So make it an image, even an SVG that has text in it or something that looks like is giving some value, and not a GIF that does a circle. I truly believe that's the reason why they did this, because they got fed up with them.
So you're saying that they're literally parsing the image and looking for something that looks like an image.
I think they're looking for detail. And it says in their blurb that they're looking for something. The largest contentful paint is the largest area that they are seeing that would or could be providing value to the user. So it could even be a massive headline, you know, large font headline taking up half of the screen, in which case, you know, if you're using a font that every browser already has installed, like Helvetica or everyone. I mean, I personally hate Times New Roman, but I've left it as my default because it's really good for spotting font faults. So it goes through me every time I see it. But Arial, these kind of fonts. On my website, we use, I think it's Helvetica.
Yeah.
Even though I love Roboto and I love Lato much, much more, if I saw Lato today and I saw Helvetica tomorrow, I'm not really going to notice the difference without thinking about it, you know?
Yeah. Lato with Google fonts.
Yeah, Google fonts are really slow to download.
Buddy.
Yeah. I've noted recently, I don't know if anyone else has noticed, but whenever I've been to Google Fonts, they tend to give you the fonts to download rather than a link to use. But I was really struggling a couple of weeks ago to find the loading font, the links that you put in.
Yeah, and even if you do that thing where you download it, then you got to upload it to your server, and it becomes another asset that has to be downloaded by the browser and all that. Yeah.
Well, that's it. That's an important point, because Google, all the fonts come from fonts.googleapis.com. And if you have one font coming from that URL, from fonts.googleapis.com, then that's one DNS server that you've got to contact, resolve, do the handshake with the SSL, get through, grab the file and bring it back. If your fonts are on your own server, on your own URL, that's already done, right? Because the server sent the document, so it's always quicker to get things off your own server. The idea behind things like Cloudflare's CDNJS libraries, where they got Font Awesome, jQuery, and I think that's the fastest one, by the way. I think that Cloudflare very much supreme, and you've got Google APIs for like the jQueries, and they're very commonly used. The idea that they can be the fastest way to load a script is because the URL is the same for everybody. And if somebody is visiting your page, the likelihood is that they've recently cached that resource. Mm-hmm. I'm skeptical. I think that there are version numbers, there are there's too many caching, adding, you know, random numbers on the end to enable cache busting later on, and all kinds of stuff going on that makes it very difficult for that to be a true reality.
So Dan, we need to kind of wrap this up soon. So I was wondering.
I could talk for hours.
I was wondering if Jonathan had one more question that he wanted to ask you, because I know that he is burning to ask like 75 more.
Yeah, I think we're good.
We just got into flow.
Exactly. We should, seriously, maybe we should do session two on this. So Dan, just tell us how should people work with you? Personally, now it's easy for me to say, right? But I think it's a total no-brainer. So, like, if you're starting out, use the most absolute minimal theme you can possibly get away with. Run your first campaigns. As soon as you've made a few bucks, hire Dan. It's that simple, right?
My most successful client, I'm in Dan Sullivan's strategic coach program. Dan's actually my coach. And he's recently come up with this thing about, are you a simplifier or are you a multiplier concept? I'm a 100% simplifier, as is Dan Sullivan. One of my clients is a 100% multiplier mindset. And he goes, I've got this product I want to sell, builds a website, uses the base one, sticks the products in there, floats it, doesn't know what he's doing, and makes millions in a very short amount of time. How did he do that? His site was loading in 1.5 seconds from the word go. Wow. Asked me what my guarantees were. We guarantee we'd be 3 seconds. And he said, I'm already doing less than 3 seconds, but let's do it anyway, because I want to see how fast you can get it. Yeah. And we had debut loading in 900 milliseconds on average. Wow. And when we did that, the algorithms loved him for it. They really did. And So anyone that's got a big beefed up theme, whether it doesn't matter which platform it's in, or using ClickFunnels is quite harsh for loading. But this is the trade-off. ClickFunnels is a very easy page builder, and they have filled a very large gap in the market, right?
Yes.
It's so easy to use, but it's got a lot of code to make that a possibility. You go into Shopify's debut and you don't have many options. You have a place to stick your image, description, and a buy now button. And that's about all you get. But that's all you need to make millions, right?
Yeah, for sure.
A compelling offer.
And the last question before you go, since you brought up Mr. Brunson's software, have you found any suitable alternatives? And I guarantee you, no builder is as fast as doing it all by hand, but like, I've heard a lot of people say the Convertry. I haven't really had a time to compare this, although I've played with it a little bit, but have you worked with anything like that and found it to be significantly better?
No, I'm much too technical. I don't like the restrictions of the build. I tend to build much more in code. I wouldn't go to a page builder. They all suffer from the same problems. That's the same thing with Thrive Themes now. I'm not saying anything bad about Thrive Themes. I'm not saying anything bad about Optimized Press. It's the fastest way to get your page loading is by reducing on the weight of the page. And the trade-off is that becomes more technical to do. So the platforms that make it easier for you to build pages inevitably bring a certain amount of bloat with them. So they're quite hard to slim down. You asked me a question before, and I think the answer was pagespeedoptimized.com. That's my new website. Optimized is spelled the American way, which is with a Z.
Bravo.
I figured that, but I also bought every conceivable version of that URL and linked them all to the same place. If you spell it wrong, you probably still find it.
Fantastic.
Right. Thanks for coming
That gets 100 on PageSpeed score, the PageSpeed score. I felt that it was important to practice what I preach. I see so many PageSpeed expert websites that got like 37 or 42.
Yeah. Well, this has been fantastic. Thanks for all this. Like, we could probably geek out on the details for hours more. But yeah, for anybody who's listening and didn't really follow all the little tech bits, we just understand that the internet is built on technology, right? Can't avoid that part. And if you're going to try to make a buck or more online, it's worth getting somebody who knows what they're doing to make sure that the beast is tame.
Yeah, great. Thanks for coming on, Don. And we'll catch up soon.
Yeah. Absolutely. Thanks for having me. It's been a joy and a pleasure.
If you've enjoyed this episode of the Maze Marketing Podcast, you'll definitely want to make sure you're on our email list. Sign up for free at www.mazemarketingpodcast.com/hello. Also, before you go, please have a think. Who's the one person you know who really needs to hear this? Please forward along this episode. It just helps to spread the word. Thanks.